Hi, everyone. Sorry for the delay in this episode. You can blame the arrival of this little monster.
Out of the thousands of adaptations of Frankenstein that have been made over the years, there's only one that we have a record of Mary Shelley actually seeing. On August 28, 1823, Mary attended a performance of Presumption, or The Fate of Frankenstein, a play written by Richard Brinsley Peake. According to a letter that she sent to Leigh Hunt, she was absolutely thrilled to see her work adapted to the stage.
But lo and behold, I found myself famous. Frankenstein had prodigious success as a drama and was about to be repeated the 23rd night at the English Opera House. I was much amused, and it appeared to excite a breathless eagerness in the audience.
It makes sense that Mary would have such a positive reaction. The play no doubt rose the story's profile significantly, and elevated Mary's career in the process. William Godwin had brought the play to Mary's attention in a letter a month earlier, writing,
"I know not whether it will succeed. If it does, it will be some sort of feather in the cap of the author of the novel, a recommendation in your future negotiations with booksellers."
It makes sense that Godwin would be thinking about negotiations with booksellers. On August 11th, just 2 weeks after the play's premiere, a new edition of the novel was published. The text is believed to have been corrected by Godwin while his daughter was spending the summer in Italy. And in this edition, unlike the first, the title page listed Mary W. Shelley as the author. So, by the end of August 1823, Mary Shelley did indeed find herself famous, and the success of Richard Brinsley Peake's Presumption played a significant part in that. It's just a shame that the play is so bad. This is Frankenstein's Afterlife. To understand the significance of what Peake does with Frankenstein in his play, it helps to back up a few decades and consider the history of Gothic theater in England. Now, when I say Gothic, I'm referring to that genre that is the predecessor of modern horror, but it's not always an easy genre to pin down. In its 18th and early 19th century manifestations, we can best define the Gothic as a loose collection of motifs that became popular in some poetry, prose, and plays of the time. Motifs like monasteries with evil Catholic monks, dark and gloomy forests, supernatural creatures, groups of bandits looking to rape and pillage, dungeons, ruins, rusting suits of armor, and most importantly, a castle. The castle, and the villainous old nobleman or noblewoman who inhabited it, is the central icon of the Gothic novel or the Gothic play, as is evident in the work of Horace Walpole. Walpole's 1764 novel, The Castle of Otranto, and his 1768 drama, The Mysterious Mother, are considered by many to be the first two works of the Gothic. The Mysterious Mother opens with the description of its setting, an old Gothic castle.
"What awful silence! How these antique towers and vacant courts dull the suspended soul, till expectation wears the cast of fear."
We then meet our protagonist, Count Edmund, who has visited the area after a long exile to marry a young woman. We also meet the Countess of Narbonne, the occupant of those antique towers, who is being consumed by guilt and tormented by a local friar for an unknown crime. At the play's climax, it's revealed that the Countess is actually Count Edmund's mother, and that the woman whom Edmund had come to marry is, unbeknownst to him, the product of the mother's and son's incestuous encounter many years ago. The Countess goes mad with guilt upon the revelation, while Edmund leaves to die in war. In one sense, this is all pure sensationalism. Walpole himself said that his goal was to create a revolution of the passions, and both the spooky castle and the wild incest plot serve the simple purpose of getting a rise out of the audience. There is, however, an important element of social satire here. The physical degeneration of the castle mirrors the moral degeneration of the aristocratic family that occupies it. The traditional family unit, an instrument for consolidating wealth and power, is rendered monstrous. These conventions that Walpole had established in the 1760s gained some real popularity in the 1790s, after the storming of the Bastille. The Gothic became a kind of protest genre, with the castle, or the convent, or the abbey, serving as a central icon of wealth and power. The plays of this period would inevitably end with some image of liberation. Either someone would be broken free from the dungeon, or the entire castle would crumble to the ground. By the 1820s, however, trends in theater had changed, and now domestic melodramas were in vogue. People didn't want to see families rendered monstrous. They wanted to see families triumph over adversity and persevere. Gothic writers adapted by relocating the monstrous outside of the home and in the form of an other. In this regard, John Polidori's The Vampire served as a useful template. In a dizzying example of the quick turnaround time in 19th century theater, Polidori's The Vampire was published in England in April of 1819 and was first brought to the stage in France in an adaptation written by Charles Nodier in June of 1820. Samuel Arnold, proprietor of the English Opera House in London, acquired a copy of Nodier's play, commissioned James Robinson Planchet to write an adaptation of it in English, and that adaptation premiered on August 19th of that same year. The story goes that J.R. Planchet, himself more a writer of melodramas, didn't want to adapt The Vampire, and only took the job because he had the idea to install a trap door on the stage, called the Vampire Trap, that would allow the monster to enter and exit almost instantaneously. The changes that he made to the source material are telling. In this version, vampire lore states that the creature must marry his victim in order to drain her blood. The vampire here is still named Lord Ruthven, but the protagonist, named Aubrey in the story, is called Lord Ronald in Planchet's play. And he is not Ruthven's traveling companion, but rather he is the father of Margaret, to whom Ruthven is betrothed. As in the story, Ruthven is eloquent and aristocratic. He even laments having to kill the beautiful Margaret.
Demon as I am, that walks the earth to slaughter and devour, the little that remains of heart within this wizard frame, sustained alone by human blood, shrinks from the appalling act of planting misery in the bosom of this veteran chieftain. Still must the fearful sacrifice be made, and suddenly, for the approaching night will find my wretched frame exhausted, and darkness, worse than death. Annihilation is my lot. Margaret, unhappy maid, thou art my destined prey. Thy blood must feed a vampire's life, and prove the food of his disgusting banquet.
The story features a second set of characters, Robert and his fiancée, Effie. At the end of Act 1, Ruthven, wanting to spare Margaret, attempts to seduce and kill Effie, but Robert walks in and shoots him. Ruthven appears to die in his friend Ronald's arms, and as in the story, he makes Ronald swear an oath not to tell anyone of his death. Act 2 opens with Ronald discovering that Ruthven is alive and still wooing Margaret. Ronald goes mad and is locked up, but unlike in the story, he is freed in time, and Ronald and Robert save Margaret, while Ruthven is killed by a bolt of lightning. It's interesting to observe how the changes that Nodier and Planchet make to Polidori's story emphasize the domestic. The addition of both a second engaged couple and a father-daughter relationship highlight healthy family units, and the focus is not on Ruthven, this monstrous but fascinating rogue traveling through Europe, but rather on the stable home that this monster is threatening. This brings us to Presumption. For anyone who's read the novel Frankenstein, the play feels like a funhouse mirror version of the story. A lot of the elements are there, but rearranged and distorted. Time and space are condensed, everything takes place over the course of a few days, and all of the action is located in the House of Frankenstein or the area surrounding Geneva. But it's the change in the characters' relationships that really stand out. The play features four different romantic pairings, none of which are the pairing best known to readers of the novel. In presumption, Victor and Elizabeth are not lovers, but rather are brother and sister. Elizabeth is in love with Victor's childhood friend Clerval, while Victor is in love with Agatha de Lacy. All of the action taking place in Geneva means that the Frankensteins and the de Lacys are family friends at the beginning of the story. Felix de Lacy and Safi remain relatively unchanged from the novel. As in the novel, Safi is an Arab Christian who, near the play's beginning, arrives in town to be with Felix, her betrothed. The blind patriarch of the de Lacy family remains in the play as well, as does Victor's younger brother, William. The fourth couple are entirely Peake's invention. Madame Ninon is Elizabeth's assistant, and her husband Fritz is Victor's. The two provide most of the play's comic relief, as in this scene where Fritz brings home groceries.
There's the trout and the sugar loaf, and the melons and the nutmegs.
But dear Fritz, where's my new beehive cap that you were to bring from the milliner's at Geneva?
Somewhere, I know. The three live ducks are lying on top of the macaroni, squeezed up under the large Gruyere cheese.
I hope to goodness my cap is not squeezed up.
It's quite safe, I tell you. I put it at the very bottom of the basket.
It will be in a nice state for my head, then.
Lord, here's a rummaging fuss for the cap. I was so nervous about it. You cautioned me so, you know. Oh dear, where is it now? Oh la, to be sure. Spousey, here it is at last. La, I knew it was safe.
Oh, Fritz, it's spoiled. That duck has been laying in it.
Not an egg, I hope, Ninon.
As a working-class buffoon, Fritz is also the character to explicitly express fear over his master's experiments, which he tries to articulate to Clerval early in the play.
Oi, Mr. Clerval! I'll tell you, one night Mr. Frankenstein did indulge himself by going to bed. He was worn with fatigue and study. I had occasion to go into his chamber. He was asleep, but frightfully troubled. He groaned and ground his teeth, setting mine on edge. It is accomplished, said he. Accomplished! I knew that had nothing to do with me, but I listened. He started up in his sleep, though his eyes were open and dead as oysters. He cried. It is animated. It rises. Walks! Now my shrewd guess, sir, is that, like Dr. Faustus, my master is raising the devil.
Fritz, you are simple. Drive such impressions from your mind. You must not misconstrue your master's words in a dream. Do you never dream?
I dream about my cow sometimes.
By the end of Act 1, Fritz's fears are validated, as the creature awakens in a scene echoing the same scene in the novel. Victor exclaims,
It lives! It lives. I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. What a wretch have I formed. I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Ah, horror! His cadaverous skin scarcely covers the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair lustrous, black and flowing. His teeth of pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only form more horrible contrasts with the deformities of the demon.
The monster escapes, terrorizes some villagers, burns down the de Lacy's cottage, and kills first William, then Agatha. Victor tracks him to a mountain, where, in the play's climax, he shoots his musket at him, triggering an avalanche that buries them both. Now, Victor's eponymous presumption, the hubris that he displays in playing God, that theme is clearly visible in both the novel and the play. But Mary Shelley's more nuanced critique, her lessons about creative responsibility and the need for empathy, are almost entirely gone, replaced with a rather simple message about the importance of domestic relationships. The play even explicitly blames Victor's work on the fact that he and Agatha had broken up.
'Twas her loss that drove me to deep and fatal experiments.
Like the vampire, this is another example of the Gothic blending with the domestic melodrama. And because the story so venerates the family and heterosexual romance, the terror has to come entirely from the threat to domestic tranquility. And so, the creature is turned into the other. In the play, Victor describes him as a huge automaton in human form. In this regard, he is more a broken piece of technology than the eloquent and sympathetic person he is in the book. And the primary way in which Peek takes away the creature's humanity is by taking away his speech. Many of Peek's changes made an impact on subsequent Frankenstein lore. He was the first to have Victor exclaim, "It lives!" at the moment that the creature awakens. And the character of the lab assistant, Fritz, would carry over into countless stage and screen adaptations. But this change, making the creature mute, feels like the most significant by far. This is the choice that made the creature into the monster. Or, more accurately, on the playbill, the nameless character is not referred to as the creature, or the monster, or the demon, the way that he is in Mary Shelley's novel and in some of the play's dialogue. Instead, the character is referred to by six dashes in between parenthetical brackets. This choice stood out to Mary Shelley.
"The playbill amused me extremely, for in the list of dramatis personae came by Mr. T. Cook. This nameless mode of naming the unnameable is rather good."
Embodying this nameless automaton was none other than Thomas Potter Cook. A working actor since he was 17, T.P. Cook found fame in 1820 at the age of 34, when he was cast as Lord Ruthven in Planchet's adaptation of The Vampire. For this role, he would receive nightly standing ovations and high praise from critics. A review in the magazine The British Stage called Cook's performance,
"one of the most vigorous and effective specimens of melodramatic acting we ever remember to have witnessed. His expressive countenance and commanding figure are displayed to great advantage, and his whole appearance is extremely picturesque."
Then, 3 years later, he was cast as, and for this role as well, he received rave reviews. Theatrical Pocket magazine wrote that Cook
powerfully embodied the horrible, bordering on the sublime or the awful. His exhibition of great strength, of towering gait, and of reckless cruelty contrasted with the fiend's astonishment on hearing a concord of sweet sounds, and on beholding female forms, or in saving a human being from drowning, was masterly.
I think it's hard to overstate Cook's contribution to the history of acting in these two roles. T.P. Cook introduced both the charismatic vampire and the Frankenstein monster to the English stage, and in so doing, solidified his place in history as the founding member of a rarefied club of great monster actors. Without T.P. Cook, there would be no Lon Chaney, no Bela Lugosi, no Christopher Lee or Doug Jones or Andy Serkis. Mary Shelley recognized his talents as well, and praised both his performance and that of James William Wallach as Victor Frankenstein.
"Wallach looked very well as Frankenstein. He is at the beginning full of hope and expectation, and at the end of the first act, the stage represents a room with a staircase leading to Frankenstein's workshop. He goes to it, and you see his light at a small window, through which a frightened servant peeps, who runs off in terror when Frankenstein exclaims, 'It lives!' Presently, Frankenstein himself rushes in horror and trepidation from the room, and while still expressing his agony and terror, throws down the door of the laboratory, leaps the staircase, and presents his unearthly and monstrous person on the stage. The story is not well managed, but Cook played Cook's part extremely well. His seeking, as it were, for support, his trying to grasp at the sounds he heard, all indeed he does was well imagined and executed."
And yet, as Mary says, the story is not well managed. Here we face what is, for me, the fundamentally troubling thing about Frankenstein's legacy. We see in this very first adaptation the same thing that we encounter time and time again in countless subsequent adaptations. The play is badly written, and badly written in a way that betrays some of the brilliant complexities that can be found in the original novel. But in the bad choices that Richard Brinsley Peek made, he opened up the possibility for new, exciting artistic explorations. Making the creature mute is a terrible idea, but only by exploring that terrible idea do we get the moving pantomime performances of T.P. Cook or Boris Karloff. I don't know what to do with that, except to say that this story isn't a fixed, inanimate thing. It lives,
It's alive!
This podcast was written, narrated, and produced by Brian Motzke at the University of Michigan. Additional voice work was provided by Stephen Nelson. And once again, Mary Shelley was voiced by Mary Shelley. You know, Mary wasn't just spending her time in 1823 going to the theater and overseeing a new edition of Frankenstein. She had other novels to write, too. That'll be the next episode of Frankenstein's Afterlife.